I'd like to begin the message by asking a somewhat rhetorical question, because I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyway. Have you ever been deceived? Have you ever been conned or tricked or in some way taken advantage of through deceit on the part of someone else or some other group or entity? When I was thinking about this message, I recalled, I hadn't thought about this for a long time, but I recall an incident that took place years ago. I was probably in my early or mid-teens. Grew up in a small town. We had about 1,000 people in town. We had two banks. We had a lot of things that over time they lost, like so much of small town America. But anyway, I was a young, probably early teens, mid-teens, and I was approached one day with an offer that seemed almost too good to be true. It turns out it was, as I learned to my chagrin. To set the scene, this was at a time when young people were being encouraged to adopt the virtue of saving, of learning to save, learning to begin to put away a little bit of what you earned, you know, through various chores, and maybe you had a paper route, or you worked, mowing lawns, whatever you did. You were encouraged as a young person to begin to develop the habit of savings. And I don't recall that I had a specific job, certainly not a regular job. I'm not sure how I came up with the money, but I took this encouragement to heart to some degree. And I remember I had gone to the bank and I had opened a savings account. Probably not a very big savings account, but I had opened a savings account. I had a little savings passbook. I was kind of proud of that. And it happened that the day the incident occurred, I was actually in front of the bank. So I think I had been there and I was leaving. Probably had my passbook in my hand. I don't recall specifically. But I was approached by a man who offered to sell me this really, really nice watch. And I said, well, I don't have any money. I don't have any money on me. He said, well, do you have any money in the bank? And I said, yeah, I have some money in the bank. He said, well, there you go. Go withdraw the money from the bank. And I did. Apparently that day, I don't recall specifically what I was wearing, but I think I might have had my I'm a Gullible Hayseed t-shirt on. It was either that or I had that look on my face that said, this guy is ripe for the plucking. But anyway, I went in, I withdrew my money, I bought the watch. I don't know if it lasted out the rest of the day. It was a somewhat gilded piece of junk. It was a waste of, literally a waste of time and a waste of money. But I learned, I suppose, a valuable lesson. This small sum of money that I had squirreled away with the hopes of seeing it grow and mature, and who knows, I might be a tycoon by now. Had I continued. But that was gone. It was all gone. And it was my fault because I was not only gullible, but I think there was probably a pretty strong element of greed in there. I saw an opportunity to get something really nice for not a lot of money. And I got something for not a lot of money, but it wasn't very nice. But anyway, I doubt that is all that unusual an occurrence. I think most of us have probably fallen victims to deceit at one time or another. Because deceit and deceitfulness is one of the most pervasive evils that affect mankind. Deceit is all around us. Deceit is practiced by any number of people in any number of ways against any number of victims. It's simply a part of our social structure. It's a part of this world's structure. Deceit is very, very commonplace. I'd like to turn to John chapter 8. We're gonna veer off the subject just slightly, but there's a reason for doing this. If you'll turn to John chapter 8, we can see something that John recorded in his gospel account that has to do with Satan. Found it interesting that in the sermonette it was mentioned that the author of confusion, you know, God is not the author of confusion, but Satan is. Satan likes to create confusion and turmoil and anarchy and uncertainty because it keeps the foundation upon which people are based moving and shaking. It makes it hard to get your bearings, and it makes it hard to continue the direction that you ought to go. Satan is the author of confusion. But in John chapter 8, there's another characterization of Satan and his attitudes and the way he thinks and the way he operates. John chapter 8 and verse 44. Jesus Christ is confronting those who were coming out trying to destroy the work that he was beginning. And he said to those that confronted him, "You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." We're all familiar with that characterization of Satan, that he is the father of lies. We've heard that any number of times, and we understand that. And if I think many of us, when we hear that, we go back to the account about what happened in the garden and his interaction with Eve. He lied to her, and he deceived her. Now, he is the father of lies, as we're told. He is a liar and the father of it. But lying is not an only child. Satan is also the father of deceit. And he uses lies to perpetuate deceit upon others. That's how he operates. That's how he makes it work. To illustrate this point, I would like to offer a question. How was Satan able to convince one-third of the angels to join his rebellion against God? How did he accomplish that? How did he do that exactly? Did he force them to join him? Did he threaten them? Did he coerce them? Or did he deceive them? Did Satan, and this is conjecture, but I wonder about this. Did he somehow convince a portion of the angelic realm who had served God for who knows how long? How long had the angels been serving under God? How long had they existed and known God's way and been taught God's way and lived God's way? And yet Satan was able to convince a significant number of them that, you know, it could be better. It could be better than it is. How did he convince them that whatever he promised them could seem in their minds to be greater than what they already had? How did he do it? I believe it was through deceit. And if that's the case, then I think it makes a warning that we read in the New Testament particularly relevant and more sobering and certainly worthy of very serious consideration. In Matthew 24:24, Jesus Christ warned. He said, "For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." Now, we tend to think of the elect, those who have their lives in order. They are committed to God. They know what God expects, or they're well on the way to learning the fullness of what God expects. the elect. These are not the casual people who have contacted God's truth or God's way just passing by. It's not a casual, not through casual contact. If Satan somehow could convince those angels that he could offer them something superior to what God offered, doesn't it seem reasonable that the elect could, in fact, be deceived? They don't have to be deceived, but they could be deceived. And we'll get into that and more of that as we go through the message. But I think it makes that warning in Matthew 24:24 much more sobering and should cause us to take it and consider it in a much more serious manner. But getting back on track, as I mentioned, Satan is the master deceiver and the father of deceit, just as he is a liar and the father of lies. Lying is not an only child. You could almost say that lying and deceit are identical twins. They're that closely related. It seems sometimes that human beings have a tendency to view deceit in a somewhat benign manner. We know it's a problem, but sometimes I think we tend to view it more as a nuisance than we do a real danger. You know, the showman, P.T. Barnum, was credited with the saying, there's one born every second. Talking about a sucker. There's one born every second. You know, there's always someone that you can deceive. There's always someone that you can take advantage of. You'll happen across them often over the course of time. Deceit is such a part of our society, and I think we tend to view it as kind of a benign manner. It's more of an inconvenience, more of an aggravation than it is a problem. But that's not the case. There's a Latin term that many of you may have heard before. Have you ever heard the term caveat or caveat emptor? It's a Latin term that means let the buyer beware. One source defines the meaning of the term in this manner. It means that the buyer assumes the risk that a product may fail to meet expectations or have defects. Beware. Don't allow yourself to be deceived. Don't buy a watch that's just too good to be true. Learn from your past mistakes and learn from the mistakes of others. And that's an advantage that we have. We can look back on history. We can see where this has taken place. We get, in many cases, pretty much the full scope of the story. And we can see how it may be a group of people, it may be a particular person, but you can read about that person or group of people. We can see the flow of the story. We can see what they had done right. We can see, the Bible tells us then, what they had done wrong, and we get to read the end result. And so we have the advantage of learning from other people's mistakes, and we can do the same thing in this matter of deceit. But the point I want to make is that deceit is so pervasive in society that we even make accommodations in our language for it. We're so accustomed to it. And as I said, sometimes we tend to view it as not that big a deal, not that important. You know, I think we're going to make just a very cursory examination of a couple of scriptures, and we can see that deceit is anything but benign or mildly harmful. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 Timothy 2:14, the account I referred to that took place in the garden. And in Timothy, it makes this statement. It says, Adam was not deceived. Perhaps that's an indictment or a stronger indictment against Adam, that he was not deceived. But the woman being deceived, it says, fell into transgression. Eve was deceived by the lies that Satan told. She chose to believe him rather than what God had told her and Adam. And that one event is what set the tone for the rest of human history and its continuation of sinful disobedience and suffering that has plagued mankind down through time. That event that took place in the garden, that deceit of Eve and and Adam's willingness to go along with it, are a testament to the destructive impact of deceit in human affairs. Think about the long-term ramifications of what occurred there. Was it benign? Was it something to kind of chuckle over and say, oh, well, you know, things happen. No big deal. I think when we look at the spectrum of human history from the time of that occurrence, we can see repeated over and over and over a cycle of violence, of hatred, of disobedience, of rebellious attitudes, of dissatisfaction. And it builds upon itself. And it had its beginning there because Eve was deceived. That kind of set the tone for the rest of human history. Another indication of how important this matter of deceit is, turn to Proverbs. The book of Proverbs, chapter 11. Proverbs 11, verse 1. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. Again, if we aren't careful, we can read over that a little too quickly. Dishonest scales. In some of your translations, there may be a marginal note that says deceitful scales. Deceitful scales are an abomination. God considers it pretty serious. God doesn't see deceit and deceitfulness as some kind of a benign little human quirk. God says it's abominable. We tend to think of it as, you know, dishonest scales. Wow. You know, there was the old story kind of a prototypical dishonest butcher. You would go in and buy a cut of meat, and they would talk about he would keep his thumb on the scales so that you pay for a little bit more than you actually got. And we look at that and we think, okay, well, you know, it's not a matter of life and death. You're just going to get cheated out of a few cents. But God says that kind of an attitude is abominable. It's hateful in his sight. He abhors that. It's serious. And so I think we have to learn to take it seriously too. There's a marginal reference relating to this statement, dishonest scales. As I said, in some translations, some Bibles, you'll see a marginal reference that say deceitful scales. And it's from the Hebrew word mirmah, which means, it says, the term signifies the intentional misleading of someone else through distorting or withholding the truth. Let's turn back to, with that in mind, turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy 32. Beginning in verse 3, Deuteronomy 32, verse 3. For I proclaim the name of the Lord. I ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are justice. A God of truth, without injustice, righteous and upright is he? So truthfulness and honesty and justice and having a just mindset is what defines God. Satan is the very opposite. Satan is the father of lies and the father of deceit and the instigator of confusion. All of those things that run counter to God. It's the direct and the exact opposite of what God is. Satan is deceitful. God is honest. His ways are justice. He is a God of truth and a God without injustice. He is righteous and he is upright. That's, I think, why God declares deceitfulness. The deceitful scales is just one example, one of many examples we could use. I think that's why God says, I find that an abomination. Because it doesn't reflect his character at all. Instead, it reflects the very nature of the adversary. The very nature of Satan is deceit. Trying to deceive someone into doing something against God's will by lying, by distorting, by confusing. So we can see that deceit is not a benign little character flaw. It's very serious. Like we see in so much of our lives as followers of Jesus Christ, as those who are called out of this world by God, we have a choice to make. Like we do in so much of life, we have a choice to make between copying God, striving after truth and honesty, or allowing ourselves to fall into the habit, perhaps unconsciously or semi-consciously, of following the way of Satan, of practicing deceit or being deceitful, or at the very least, not being all that put off by it. Willing to accept a certain amount of deceit because it's really not that important when it is. So we have a choice to make. We have to choose. And the choice that we make, like the choice in so many situations, will have eternal consequences. Who we choose to follow will have eternal consequences. And so we need to look at these things and try to see them as God would see them. And if God says that he finds something abominable, then perhaps we should make an extra effort to steer clear of it and to avoid it in our lives. I said before that deceit is so pervasive and so pernicious within our society. How long has Satan been sowing deceit along with his lies throughout the world? Sowing those lies that ultimately we end up seeing that they are so deeply interwoven into the world that we now inhabit that sometimes we become blind to it. It's so omnipresent that we get used to it. It doesn't get us upset any longer. How long has Satan been doing that? When we stop and realize, except for a short period of time at the very beginning of the creation of mankind, don't know exactly how long that was, but there was a period of time when Adam and Eve were accustomed to walking in the garden with God. Satan wasn't on the scene. And then there came a point in time where the interaction between Satan and Eve took place. From that point forward, throughout the entirety of human history up until today, and we know it's going to extend beyond by a certain period. There has never been a time other than that short period right at the beginning of the creation of humanity when Satan hasn't been on the scene, when Satan hasn't been sowing lies and deception wherever he can, whenever he can, however he can, against whomever he can. It's been a constant throughout almost the entirety of human history. Knowing that fact, I was thinking when I was putting this together, and what prompted this message, I was thinking about some of these things before. And I had a couple of questions that I've kind of, they run through my mind from time to time over the course of time. But when we go back and we read the biblical history from, as I said, from the time of Adam, throughout the historical account as contained in the Bible, we read about what occurred in the garden. We read about what occurred involving Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We read about the history of Israel in Egypt. We read about the history after God brought them out of Egypt and their journey through the promised land, through the wilderness to the promised land. We can read the account of the period of time after Israel had come into the land and God was governing through the judges. We can read the account of the time after the judges when Israel demanded a king and God acceded to their request and gave them a king. And so we can read the account about the kings and on down through the history as contained in the New Testament. And the one thing that keeps happening over and over and over, it's like a rolling tide in history, is a short period of obedience and a period of disobedience and rejection of God, and then turmoil, and then crisis, and then crying out for deliverance, and then a time of hearing God, understanding that a people has been delivered, and then that long slide back into disobedience and allowing human nature to take over. And that's happened over and over and over and over again. And when you read that account, sometimes I think we can come away with questions in our mind about if that is the 6,000-year history of humankind, do we really have a realistic expectation of seeing things change? Of seeing mankind finally, genuinely turning to God, genuinely committed to obedience to God. Is there a hope for that? Well, we know that there is. We can also read in the Bible the prophecies about what's going to occur at the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of God's government. We know that time is going to take place. But why do we have any expectation that it will be different then, rather than just perhaps a brief respite and then back into trouble again? What gives us the hope that things will ever be any different? That hope is the fact that there is coming a time when Satan will be bound, when he will be removed, and he will no longer be able to deceive mankind. There will finally come a time in the history of humankind when Satan will not be involved. He won't be there. He won't be able to deceive and to distort and to confuse. He will be put away where he can no longer impact the affairs of mankind. In Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3, it says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold on that dragon, that serpent of old, who was the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more." Satan will, there will come a point in time for the first time in some 6,000 years, that Satan will not be able to work deceit and lying against humankind, when he will be restrained. That's what makes the difference. That deceit is removed. Mankind is no longer battling that particular battle. The impact of deceit has been a powerful negative force in this world and has contaminated mankind to a much greater degree than we realize, and only God's calling and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ can draw us up out of the mire and give us the hope of the glorious future in God's kingdom. In reading that history that I mentioned related by the Bible, and seeing Israel and Judah and mankind as a whole, that dismal record of turning their backs on God, refusing to listen to him, we see that there's finally an answer to the question, how can we expect anything different? Because Satan will be bound. It's all about identifying the problem and removing the problem, eliminating the problem. And Satan is the one who is to blame, and the solution is his removal to a place from which he can no longer exert his influence over human affairs. You know, today we live in a world, and this is why I make the statement that deceit is so toxic and so damaging and so corrosive. We live in a world that largely rejects God and, as a matter of fact, refuses to listen to him or to even believe that he is. A growing portion of society, of this world, simply does not believe that there is a God. They don't reject God. They deny God. They deny that he is. And that's a growing percentage of the world's population. Why? Because they're deceived. Because they're confused. Because they bought the lie that says, there's no God. We're all the product of some great evolutionary plan that's taken place. We don't need God. And so the world has rejected him. It's the very contradiction, the very opposite of what we read in Hebrews 11, verse 6, in part. Hebrews 11, verse 6, where it says, "For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them who diligently seek him." You know, we're starting to get the feast announcements now. And the fall holy days, in particular, remind us that there is a solution coming to the problem of deceit. That Satan, through his removal and his being put in a place where he can't impact the affairs of mankind, then men's minds will be changed from rejecting God to humbly seeking him and listening to him. Turn over to Zechariah chapter 8. You're all very familiar with this particular verse. It's one of my favorite verses in the Bible. Zechariah chapter 8. Because it tells how that attitude is going to be at a future point in time. Instead of an attitude of rejecting God and disbelieving in him, in his existence and his power, this will be the attitude that will begin to develop once Satan is no longer around to deceive mankind. Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days 10 men from every language of the nation shall grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. We know that there's a God. We've heard about this God. And we know that there are some that are more familiar with God. There are some who can guide us to him so that we can learn from him, so that we can hear him, and so that we can begin to mold and model our lives on his instructions. That's a big part of the message of the Feast of Tabernacles, is the fulfillment of that time read about in Revelation chapter 20. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah 19. Beginning in verse 21. Isaiah 19, verse 21. And then the Lord will be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day, and will make sacrifice and offering. Yes, they will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. And the Lord will strike Egypt. He will strike and heal. They will return to the Lord, and he will be entreated by them and heal them. In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel will be one of the three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. These people who have been the long-time historical enemies of Israel and of God will go through a radical change. They will seek God. Why? I think we have to ascribe the reason in large part to the fact that Satan will no longer be around to deceive and to create the confusion that we've seen that exists in this world today, that plays on the nature of human beings, the negative aspects of human nature. The second question that kind of rumbled around in my mind from time to time is the question I'm sure many of you have thought about. Why would people, after living under the rule of God for 1,000 years and enjoying his blessings and all that that entails, why would someone seeing centuries of God's rule, why would they ever be willing to give that up and to walk away from it? When I read Revelation chapter 20, verse 3, I purposely left off reading the last part of that. It says at the end of verse 3, Satan will be bound, but after these things, it says, he must be released again for a little while. So apparently Satan is released. He goes out. He hasn't changed. It's worked for so long. I simply go out, I propagate, and I proclaim my false message, and I gather a group of beings to me. It's worked before. Why change now? And so Satan will go forth, and there will be a certain number that will buy into the lies and that will allow themselves to be deceived. Even after 1,000 years under God's rule, how is that possible? I think we have to go back to the beginning. How was it possible for him to convince that the angels that followed him into rebellion, how did he convince them? He deceived them. He deceived them. How long had those angels been following God's ways, and yet they listened to the deceiver? and apparently it will happen again. The Bible provides us with protection against that. We don't have to just fall victim to being deceived. There's an antidote that we're given through biblical admonition. One of those is in James. James chapter 4, verse 8 says in part, "Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you." Make an effort to connect with God, and make an effort to stay connected with God. Our human tendency sometimes is to hit a certain plateau. You know, we grow to a certain point, we hit a plateau, and we think, "Whew, I can stop and rest for a minute now." And maybe we can, to a certain degree. But the danger in doing something like that is we lose our momentum, and we start to slide back. And suddenly, the things that we see around us, you know, they're just not really that bad. And if we aren't careful, we can regress, and we can slide back into what we've come out of. James is saying, draw near to God. And I think implied in that statement is stay near to him. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. In Hebrews chapter 10, I'd like to read part of verse 19 and part of verse 22. Hebrews 10, 19. "Therefore," it says, "brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus Christ," that is, to come before God, to come near God, to draw near God, "having boldness to do that, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith." A true heart, a committed heart, a dedicated heart. A heart that stays focused on God and doesn't decide to take too many rests, too many stops along the way. In the Amplified Classic, that portion is rendered this way. It says, "Let us all come forward and draw near with true, honest, and sincere hearts in unqualified assurance and absolute conviction engendered by faith, by that leaning of the entire human personality on God in absolute trust and confidence in his power, his wisdom, and his goodness." An unqualified assurance and conviction. A conviction that when someone says, "Hey, you know what? I've got a better way," we say, "No. No. That's impossible. You could not have a better way than what God offers. It doesn't get better. No matter what kind of a picture you try to paint, it doesn't get better. And I have the utmost assurance that God will deliver on his promises." That is what helps us to maintain that closeness to him. We live in a world of growing uncertainty and confusion, a world that would and could, if we fail to be diligent in our efforts to stay close to God, could result in us being deceived and denied entry into God's family. It is an important matter, avoiding deceit and not falling victim to it. Our adversary would like nothing better than to see us fail. He desires our destruction through any means possible. Any means. Deception is not something trivial. Its impact can be devastating and permanently destructive. Let's let the world crumbling around us and the confusion that we see of these current times, let's let it serve to motivate us to seek God and to focus on the things that really matter. And let's remember the admonition we find in Hebrews chapter 3. We'll find one more verse and we'll close this up. Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews 3, beginning in verse 12. Brethren, or beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin.